Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre podcast for the 17th of August 2014. My name's TRP Watson. This week I'm joined by Johnny Fox, Nick from Partially Obstructed View, and Gareth James.
We're now going to talk about My Night with Reg, which is on at the Donmar Warehouse. This is Kevin Elliott's 1994 play, which was done at the Royal Court and starred the likes of John Sessions, Anthony Carf, and David Bamber. It's been revived at the Donmar with Julian Ovenden, Geoffrey Streatfeild, Jonathan Broadbent, Matt Bardock, Richard Canton, Lewis Reeves. John, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
Let's start by talking about the story, which is sort of Peter's Friends meets Abigail's Party. It's a group of gay men, and it's an unusual casting in that there are six characters and they're all male and they're all gay. I think apart from Boys in the Band, I can't think of another play that has an all-gay dramatist personae. And we are in the late 80s, early 90s. AIDS has become really its ugly head, has devastated the urban population at least. And this is a sequence of gatherings of people who were once bonded together as university friends over three successive, what you might call social occasions. But because two of the occasions are funerals, it's not entirely happy. It sounds like a very sombre and solemn subject. But the brilliance of My Night with Reg is that it is an hilarious comedy. And I think because of the way in which Kevin Elliott manages to write dialogue and create very credible characters and have them spark off each other, even with this very macabre background of what's going on to them and their friends, is why this play is perhaps deserving of a revival, and why, in my memory at least, it survives with more depth and more resonance than the imported polemical plays that were over here at about the same sort of time, like Angels in America and The Normal Heart. It was extremely well cast in 1994. As you said, Anthony Carf, John Sessions, David Bamber really made this triumvirate of guys, two of whom are smart and handsome and successful, and the other one, played then by David Bamber and now by Jonathan Broadbent, is little chubbier, little less physically attractive, very homely, very reliable, and he becomes everybody's best friend. He is the one who hosts all the parties, who provides all the food and the drink and the bonhomie and the warmth, and he's obviously a lovely person, except in that age, he has not been successful as becoming anybody's lover. And part of really what we're talking about is that it's... What do they say about him? They say he's too cautious. That's right. He even masturbates in marigolds. And he lives in a decade when kindness and generosity were really sort of dismissed in popular favour of, I don't know, the curve of a buttock or the heft of a cock as seen in the half light of heaven or on the heath, because that's how people tended to consume sex and romance even in those days. So I think Elliott is brilliant at forcing his characters to face the shattered mirror of their lives. And I think both Robert Hasty as the director and all of the cast are really fine in the unflinching way in which they approach this task, as well as being extremely deft at timing the comedy. I think the two outstanding performances really are Julian Ovenden, a lovely, practiced, easy, romantic hero kind of charm. And he comes from a background of privilege and inherited money and an obvious, you know, sense of entitlement. And either, depending on how well you like what he does, either that is an immaculately detailed performance or it's ripped directly from Hugh Grant in About a Boy. I think the greater characterization is the character that I found easiest to identify with and to like, which is Geoffrey Streatfeild's globe-trotting adventurer Daniel, who has a high-flying career as an art consultant, a high-octane relationship with the eponymous Reg, a vigorous sexual appetite, and best of all, a really deeply acidulated tongue. And he gets the best lines in the show, and he delivers them with fantastic timing and really, really savours them, such that the audience, you know, are blown away by the strength and humour of his delivery. So what I think it is, this play, is rather than just a drawing room comedy, which, of course, it looks like a drawing room comedy, and with this structure that it's the same characters, minus the ones who died, appearing in each successive scene on the same set with years separating them. And so it could be like, is it Eight Born's Absurd Person Singular that's set in three kitchens and three Christmases and it has that very rigid format with the same people? Or it could be like the Norman Conquest, you know, the same people in slightly different situations. So it could be like that. But as I say, also, it could be slightly a sort of Abigail's Party for the AIDS era as well. I sort of parallels with that as well, because it is very much about manners and how people relate to each other. And also, you know, a very prominent offstage character, an offstage activity as well. It's very well staged. The set is beautiful. I thought it was quite funny that as a comedy about gay sex and the importance of protection, it's a bit unwittingly symbolic that it starts with a young painter and decorator glossing the woodwork in a conservatory at the back of the stage without any kind of sheet to protect from the white splashes. I thought that was quite ironic as well. I think it's worth saying that there's some full frontal nudity in this, which won't offend anybody because it's very beautifully done. I'm just not sure that the very, very well-honed gym bodies and tans are really quite accurate for 1994, but, you know, perhaps I wasn't paying attention carefully enough back then.
Nick, what did you think about this?
Previously, I'd seen only the TV version of I think it was some of the original cast. So this was my first time seeing it on stage. I thought it's a very, very strong production, and it kind of left me thinking, given that it's kind of 20 years old, it's surprising that it's not been revived much. Possibly it might have done on tour and things, but it's not really been seen much in London since. And I think that's one of the things that's striking about it, is how well it stood up in that time. And I think, I mean, in recent years, a couple of theatres have kind of revived a few of the AIDS dramas of that time, a few of the American ones as well. And I think this, possibly because, you know, I think they've done it because the subject's become a bit more topical again, with people kind of thinking that they don't need to be as careful anymore, and, you know, the infection rate's rising. So there's been kind of a revival of some of the more overtly political and kind of frightened and frightening plays about the subject. So it does kind of stand out why this is kind of superior, is because it's not about an illness, it's about people. I mean, obviously, John mentioned that it doesn't actually say the name of the illness, but there's not really any need to. It's quite obvious what it's about. But it's about the people affected. It's not about kind of statistics and illness. It's about people kind of trying to get on with their lives with something kind of the big shadow behind it. This is the thing, because it doesn't play out as, you know, an AIDS drama in inverted commas. That's why I think it's so effective, and it still feels pretty universal. It feels like a period piece, because obviously it's set at a very particular time, but then, you know, anything is likely to be of its time. I think, you know, again, the mention of Abigail's Party, that's always going to be a period piece, but it's got a universality, and this is the same. And it's a great production. I must say, I did also think there was maybe a bit more kind of grooming going on for possibly early 90s bit of rough, which might have been the intention there. But I, you know, apart from that, I don't think there's, you know, anything to complain about the cast. They all look right and absolutely feel right. Jeffrey Stratfield is really fantastic. He's I think you really see the development over the three scenes. The play is kind of written to sort of fool you a bit. It is kind of three scenes that take place in the same location but quite a long time apart. But it's kind of written in a way that you're meant to sort of think at first that the second scene follows just maybe an hour or so after the first. And I think the production kind of plays well with that, with the trick there, but also making it clear once it's got going that actually a lot of time has passed, so you know you can follow exactly what Elliot's doing with the structure of it. there's a real there's a lovely sort of development in Geoffrey Stratfield as the character who kind of is the most kind of not sort of a camp stereotype, but someone who enjoys playing up to a certain kind of who's sort of performing at all times, and because of the way his story goes, you see him change and kind of reveal more of himself to the people who, you know, you would think he would be most open with to start with, and you really kind of see layers in his character. So it's a lovely performance, but all six of them are very well cast, and it's just a great little production. It is very funny. I think having subsequently seen kind of where Elliot's writing went with Clapham Junction, you can kind of see that there is sort of a nastiness and kind of a self-hatred in there, became pretty much the only beat that Clapham Junction had. But here it's kind of is found a balance to tell what actually is quite a dark story in many ways, but in a very entertaining way. And I think it's well worth reviving and it's well worth seeing. Gareth?
Yes, I saw the original production 20 years ago, and my recollection was that I thought it was very funny, it was a very good piece of writing, it was very well performed. But I was a bit kind of surprised, as it was a sort of post-AIDS play, the first British post-AIDS play. I was a bit surprised at the sort of the unprotected sex, the promiscuity, that you know, people hadn't sort of even, seemed to me, hadn't even woken up to what was happening in the world. And I think it's fascinating that the first British response to AIDS on the stage was actually a comedy like this, rather than the sort of more earnest things like Angel in America and The Normal Heart and As Is and all of those, really. And I think that's something very peculiarly British, it seems to me. And yet, I still think it's very powerful in terms of sort of representing what was happening at that time. I thought, though, before I went to see the revival, I thought it was probably a play of its time, and I wasn't convinced that, you know, it would have much impact today. And I was wrong. And I think one of the reasons why it might not have been produced is because other people might have thought that, you know, this was a play of its time, and why should we put it on now, really? But I think what was striking to me is that it's such a well-written play, and it's not at all predictable or obvious, really. And you have to work a bit at it, because you're in the third scene and it takes you a while before you work out whose wake you're at, really. And I just think it's a very, very good piece of writing. And I think now, you know, looking at it now, it seems to me that it was certainly Kevin Elliott's masterpiece. And I do think it's actually probably a modern classic. And I think that's what the Donmar have kind of proven, really, that it isn't a play of its time. That it is just a bloody good play, and it is incredibly funny. There isn't a wasted moment in the play, really. I mean, it's, you know, it's only hour and three quarters or something like that long, and it's really kind of very sort of densely packed with narrative and characterization, and I think it works remarkably well today. And sadly, of course, Kevin Elliott died days before before the rehearsal started, so he didn't get to see the first major revival of his masterpiece. I mean, he only wrote six stage plays over a period of about 22 years. He wasn't really a very prolific writer, and even though he wrote good plays after this, I mean, he wrote Mouth to Mouth, which I think the Royal Court put on, 40 Winks, which is also the Royal Court, so he did other things the Royal Court in the early noughties, around sort of 2001, 2003, 2004, something like that. Nothing he did really stood up to this in terms of quality. I think this was his, you know, this was the pinnacle of his career, and it would have been lovely for him to have seen this superb production. I think it's worth saying that, you know, this is probably Robert Hastie's biggest moment, because he's done a lot of smaller scale work and assistant directors, but I think this is his first kind of big opportunity, and I think he really grasps that and delivers something very fine as a production. And he does have an absolutely fabulous cast. I mean, there isn't a fault in the casting for me, and I mean, you know, you've both talked about Geoffrey Stratfield, who I think is just terrific. He just kind of lurches onto the stage with such charisma and kind of sweeps you away, really. So I think it's, you know, it's a very, very good production of what I now believe is a modern classic. And my little bit of trivia to end with is that the original actor who played Eric, who's the the decorator, as it were, is the guy, actor Joe Dutine, who's now graduated to being Sally's boyfriend in Coronation Street. So there we are. That's Gareth's bit of trivia.
We're now going to talk about Holy Warriors at Shakespeare's Globe. This is a new play by David Eldridge and chiefly talks about Richard I and Saladin and the kind of truce they came to in the Third Crusade, but also gives us a glimpse into what might happen in the future. Nick, what did you think about this, and tell me more about it?
I read an interview with Dave Eldridge saying that he, when he started writing this, he was going to write a history play about the Crusades, and very quickly realised that it was kind of too big a subject to write a straightforward history play, and so he started writing something else. I would be interested to know what he thinks he has actually written, because I'm not sure what it is. I can kind of see what the intention behind it is, but this is a really confused and confusing show, and it's a shame because it's got some good actors in it, and they're kind of trying to... It's still, whatever kind of play he's ended up writing, it's still trying to cram in about a millennium's worth of history into a couple of hours, and obviously not quite managing to, because you can't do that. Well, it sort of is. It starts out as a straightforward kind of period dress history play of Richard the Lionheart's crusade against Saladin, and it kind of goes along not necessarily that interestingly until... I mean, Alexander Siddig, who plays Saladin, is he's good, but the way that all the... He kind of the first half an hour or so is setting up him becoming powerful in the Middle East and taking over Jerusalem and sort of becoming this figure who Richard the Lionheart decides to... becoming the nemesis for him. But it's directed so kind of dreamily and kind of... it's kind of done through syrup, because there's all this sort of chanting going on throughout, and it's like the acting's been allowed to stay at that level. So it starts really uninterestingly. It kind of picks up because John Hopkins kind of explodes onto the stage as Richard the Lionheart, and he's got kind of this awkward alliance of kind of great mutual dislike with the French king, who's played by Julian Coy. So it kind of feels like it's going to really get somewhere, and it's sort of building up this relationship, and you look forward to where it's going to go with the confrontation. And then it kind of gets weird, because it sort of jumps forward several years to his death and then beyond his death. And the second act kind of takes you into possibly purgatory, where his mother, Ellen of Aquitaine, kind of gives him and the audience a potted history of the Middle East. And then we get him attempting to redo everything, and it essentially takes up the story again, but in modern dress and as kind of a modern version, but everything sort of still happens the way it did in the original Crusade. And I just don't know what it is, really. I'm not an expert in that particular period of history. I'm not sure a lot of people going to see this will be. I think probably people who do know a lot about it will be frustrated at the sort of big jumps that sweep away centuries at a time and kind of go, oh, well, that happened. Let's see how this is relevant to today. But then if you don't know every little detail of Middle Eastern history between the Crusades and present day, it's still incredibly confusing, because it does do that. It kind of jumps around, and the thrust of the second act is that Richard gets a chance to relive and redo the Crusade and see if it works out any differently. I mean, the problem for me is it took until the end when they actually pointed this out. I sort of assumed that what we were seeing was still history playing out and nothing was changing. But I mean, until it was sort of confirmed right at the end, I didn't know that, because I don't know that history. And I think that for me, that was actually one of the larger problems of it, is that the entire kind of second act is based around a sort of alternate history, or maybe it's not. I mean, you know, it's something that you're not quite sure what story it's telling you. And Saladin kind of fades away into the background, which is a shame because you've kind of been looking forward to the sort of contrast between them and the conflict, and that never really comes. This often happens, I think, with new plays at the Globe. Every so often you get one that is absolutely amazing, and to get to them, there's a lot that just seem to find it such a strange challenge to write for the place and sort of try to become epic in a way that they don't really succeed in. And I think this is the thing, like, they're often attempting to be epic in the space and end up being sort of incomprehensible and quite dull in this case. And I think people, you know, I don't know, I mean, I remember last year that for me the absolute standout new play last year at the Globe was Blue Stockings. And one of the things I thought about that was it worked beautifully, and I could imagine it working anywhere else as well. You know, it worked beautifully for the space and beautifully for anywhere else. And I wonder if that's the thing, if writers kind of come in there with this mentality of, oh, the Globe's such a particular space and they want to write something for it. And I think they just should write something that could work anywhere, because I think when you're trying to fill this space, you often end up with some really odd and not very interesting things going on. And I'm afraid that's what's, for me, that's what's happened here. I don't know if that's what everybody thought about it.
David Eldridge is a bit of a problem playwright for me, because he's written great plays like In Basildon, which I think is a superb play, and then he's written just dreadful plays like Not of the Heart. And I think what's gone wrong here for me is that I think he's been overambitious. I mean, he's basically calling this a fantasia on the Third Crusade and the history of violent struggle in the Holy Lands. That's his description of it. And the first act for me, which is the crusade, you know, the historical bit, or the initial historical bit, is very laboured and actually quite long for what, you know, for what it contains. And then you get this kind of potted history lesson, you know, where you get Ben Gurion and Golda Meir and Sadat and Bush and Blair and whatever, which is, for me, you know, just oversimplifies what is an incredibly complex issue, and I felt didn't really do justice or give respect to this issue. Indeed, an issue that at this point in time is, you know, is still uppermost in our minds because of what's going on in the Middle East at the moment. And then, as Nick says, you get this sort of third bit where you're thinking, well, what's going on now? I mean, the issue deserves something, you know, like those wonderful tricycle plays, the sort of whole day examination of a subject in great depth, The Great Game, for example. I think that's what this subject needs, rather than this kind of fantasia, as he calls it. So I felt it was just overambitious. It didn't deliver on that ambition, I'm afraid. I admire the Globe for putting on new writing, and as Nick says, you see someone like Blue Stockings and you think, well, but then a lot of other things hasn't worked, and this one I don't think works either. I think, you know, the production is kind of focuses much more on the kind of spectacle than it does on the narrative and the story, in a way. And I think the performances are fine. I thought John Hopkins was a particularly good Richard the Lionheart. And I think at the end, when they then do the usual Globe thing of the dance, I think, oh my God, what are you doing here at the end of this play? Why are you doing that? So I found it a very, very disappointing evening. And I think for me, it's just a lot of ambition that hasn't really, you know, that hasn't really paid off here.
Both myself and the friend I went with were really quite amazed that they would stick with the jig at the end of this. I mean, it's kind of ending with a story that's literally going on the day you're going to see it. And it's fine sort of having everybody who's dead stand up at the end of Titus Andronicus and do a dance. I think here it's kind of really insensitive. And, I mean, you always get the planes going over the Globe, which, you know, you can't do anything about it. It's potluck when they're going to come over. So when I saw it with the misfortune of a plane coming over exactly the point that George Bush character was describing in quite some detail, the 9/11 attack. And, you know, that's really unfortunate and you can't do anything about that. But you can do something about not having people who are kind of playing people who actually might have died that day in Gaza stand up and do a dance at the end. So I think there's a lot of ways this is kind of misjudged.
I don't like saying those things about David Eldridge, because I think he's a, you know, he's a trier as a playwright, and he does write good stuff on occasions. I mean, and it's a bit difficult to say whether he should be doing sort of small-scale stuff or big-scale stuff. I mean, some of the things his small-scale stuff hasn't worked, as you said, Knock of the Heart, and his big stuff like Market Boy, that didn't really work when he did it at the National. But he's, you know, he's always a playwright worth watching, I think. But I don't like to say slightly out of his depth, but it does feel like that sometimes. It's that he hasn't really focused on it. There's no good answer to this, and he doesn't really have one. And I think that's really kind of one of the problems behind this play, is that you can sit there and point out everything that's wrong and how it went wrong, and perhaps it's this. I think the idea of that he's trying to get across is the idea that Western hubris, in many ways, it's, you know, that the way that the West has interfered in the Middle East and not shown some, you know, occasionally shown some respect, because I think that's what really why we get the idea that history may or may not repeat, is whether he's prepared to sort of bow his head and go as a lowly person into the world. So I think that that's kind of his message, but as you say, it is a little bit muddled, and there are certain other things you'd like. You know, I'm not going to say I didn't like it, because I liked enough of it, but I didn't think it was really a great play or that much of a good play. I mean, it was just, I kind of enjoyed the ride, but I was disappointed in it, I think, is what I can say about it, really.
I mean, the point he's trying to make, it seems to me, is that, you know, it's been going on forever and it's all our fault. And that's just, you know, that's just oversimplistic. And I think that's where he falls down, really. That doesn't do the subject justice.
There was, like I say, this was quite one of those, there was a lot of discussion on the way out. I think that the metaphor doesn't really work for the present day. I mean, because it's mentioned kind of briefly that we're talking about actually in the crusade in question, the Christians would have been an oppressed minority. And obviously the Jews at the time were being oppressed by nobody more so than Richard the Lionheart. So it's kind of trying to stretch this metaphor that really doesn't work if you stop and think about it for too long. You know, and because obviously religion is such a major part of it, the when actually the participants are completely different, it doesn't work as a metaphor. It doesn't work as saying, well, this is what it is. Well, actually, you know, well, there's completely different people involved, and the sides are not the same.
We're now going to talk about Porgy and Bess, which is on at the Open Air Theatre in Regent's Park. This, of course, is George Gershwin's musical. Gareth, tell me more about it and what you thought of it.
Well, I think it's always been considered more of an opera or perhaps a folk opera than a musical. It's the 1930s it was written, and a few weeks back we were talking about the Noel Coward, this is a Man Band play. And it's a kind of contemporary of that, and yet it's significantly more shocking, you know, because it's sex, drugs, murder, racism, and you name it on the stage, really. And so this was being put on in Broadway while this was A Man was being banned in London, which I found extraordinary, given that I saw the two shows sort of very close to one another, really. I think it's a crossover piece, that's the reality, because it's got sort of classical sensibilities, jazz, blues, spiritual. And I think it was a very groundbreaking show, clearly, at its time, you know, because this came way before the sort of the Rodgers and Hammerstein shows like Carousel and so on. I've seen it before, but mostly as an opera, or indeed I've seen it twice as an opera, I think, and once in a fairly operatic West End production that Trevor Nunn did in, I think it was 2012 maybe. This is a different version, because this is a shortened version that was produced on Broadway that I think we've probably not seen here before, which was adapted by Susan Laurie Parks and Deirdre L. Murray. And Timothy Sheeder of the Open Air Theatre has kind of chosen to use that version, which I think is very wise, because I think the longer version is overlong, and particularly in the first half is actually a bit ponderous. This is still, for me, a bit ponderous in the first half, but nowhere near as much as the other longer versions that I've seen, really. And it's a story set in a community which is called Catfish Row. The community is kind of unsettled by the arrival of this woman called Bess, who's a woman of fairly dubious morals, really. She's got a drug habit. She's got a city boy sporting life in tow, and a bullying boyfriend called Crown in tow. And we then sort of see how these people shake up this community. Porgy, of the title, is a disabled
man who falls for Bess and has an on-off relationship with Bess, and then it becomes a tragedy. Despite the sort of the slowness of the first half, although the first half does contain some absolutely gorgeous songs like I Got Plenty of Nothing and Ain't Necessarily So, it's much more dramatic in the second half. All the sort of action really takes place in the second half. And the staging in the second half, particularly there's a storm scene, was outstanding. And then Bess's struggle with drugs and drink is very realistically portrayed in this version, and great sensitivity by Nicola Hughes, who plays Bess. And there is a more of a sense of a community struggling to survive, really, and surviving by kind of sticking together and being very supportive of one another. So you get more of that community feel, I think, in this production. So I think they've done a very good job with it. Some stylized movement, but very effective. I think Lime Steel did the choreography and the movement. They've imported a lot of US male leads, which I was kind of a bit puzzled by, because I thought, you know, we've got some great black actors here. Why is this happening? But, you know, they are all good. You know, Philip Brooklyn, whose Crown is excellent. Sporting Life, Cedric Neal is really, really good. And then you've got a very, very empathetic Porgy from Rufus Bonds Jr. So I suspect there may be something of a co-production going on here. The ladies, in addition to Nicola Hughes, we get Sharon D. Clarke again, giving us yet another of her masterclasses in acting and singing, who plays Mariah. And then we've got Jade Ewin, who plays Clara, and Golda Ruchabel, who plays Serena. The design jars a bit. Katrina Lindsay, who's normally a very reliable designer, has for some reason put this giant metallic cliff backdrop. That's a bit like a giant sculpture that you might see in Tate Modern. As it gets dark, the lighting kind of, you know, makes it change colour and changes mood, and it does look pretty. But I think it is a bit incongruous, really. And that, for me, didn't entirely work. But it's great to see this show. It absolutely is lovely in the open air, obviously, provided you get a decent evening. I mean, it's lovely in the open air theatre. It works really, really well on that stage. And I thoroughly enjoyed it and was really glad to have a chance to see this alternative version.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page in Facebook. On the web, we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.